Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where would you find the strength to maintain your dignity, your sanity, and your optimism for the future if you were kept away from everyone and everything you loved for years on end? In the early weeks of 2002, Ingrid Betancourt's prospects for a bright future seemed more or less unlimited. Elected to the Colombian Senate in 1994 on an anti-corruption platform, 8 years later, this 41-year-old mother of two teenagers was campaigning for her country's presidency when she came upon an unexpected roadblock in a region known for criminal activity by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. Before Betancourt and her companion could turn their car around, they were taken hostage. And Betancourt spent the next 6.5 years of her life at the mercy not only of abusive and immature captors, but of fellow prisoners whose fear and suffering tended to divide rather than unite them. Ingrid Betancourt's memoir of her experiences is out now in trade paperback. It's called Even Silence Has an End, My 6 Years in Captivity in the Colombian Jungle. Ingrid, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be with you today.
I want to start with how you ended up as a hostage. You knew when you scheduled to travel to San Vicente that it was a sort of safe haven region for the FARC, but initially you were told you'd have a full security detail. How did that change?
Well, it was a day of very confused and confusing decisions. It was that zone where I was going to travel. It was the zone where the government had held peace negotiation and peace talks with the FARC, with the guerrilla that finally abducted me. And 2 days prior my trip, the peace process ended abruptly. And so the government was very keen in demonstrating that he was able to get control of the zone very quick and to just evict the FARC, this rebel group, from the zone. And the day I was going to San Vicente, which was the place where the peace talks had been held, the government wanted to show that it was a safe zone, that it was under control of the military, and there was a huge military operation that day. So it was kind of odd to see that I was in the middle of this huge military operation, and at the same time the government was taking away my escort. Hmm. But in a way, it was difficult to just at that moment to assess what was happening. I think that nobody could just foresee that the FARC would be as audacious as to install a roadblock in the middle of that military operation. And I was captured that same day.
Did they know it was you at the moment they stopped your car?
I am convinced they were waiting for me. Hmm. They knew it was me. They wanted to capture me. Of course, at the beginning, I didn't think that way. When I was captured, I thought it was a mistake. But after years of being in captivity and listening to the conversations the guards had and the comments and what they would say, it appeared that it was an operation that was launched to abduct me.
And from the moment that you saw that the militants who stopped your car were wearing rubber boots and not leather boots, you knew you were in trouble. Can you explain why that was?
Well, yes, this is kind of a code. But in Colombia, Colombia at the time, perhaps not so much anymore, but at the time it was a country with a very high level of violence. There was a civil war going on, and all kind of groups were acting in a violent way, especially terrorists. And there were some that were paramilitaries, like the right extreme wing ones. The guerrillas were the leftists. And the curious thing was that everybody was wearing military uniform. Hmm. So for civilians, it was very difficult to just know who you were confronted to, because they were all like wearing the same clothes. So the way it was a way of for civilians to just try to see and to guess who we had in front of us was by looking at the boots. The only ones that got the possibility of having leather boots were the the military, the soldiers. So whenever you were confronted with people in uniform with rubber boots, you knew they were from the guerrillas, and probably also from the paramilitaries, but mostly the guerrillas. At least you knew those guys were rebels. They were not from the Colombian army. So that was what happened that day. When I saw the roadblock, I couldn't know if it was part of the military operation that was going on or if it was the guerrilla. And the first thing I did was to look at the feet of the guys. And when I saw they were wearing rubber boots, it really was scary.
Hmm. And Ingrid, initially your sense was that your part of all this would be over in a matter of days, because it would seem that you were, as a hostage, an asset too valuable not to trade away, and that somehow you would be out before too long.
Yes, that's what I thought. But there were many things that I thought that came to be wrong. For example, I thought that the political class, I mean, I was running for presidency, and I was expecting that the other candidates would fight for me. I thought that something I would have done, mm-hmm. in the sense that you cannot continue campaigning if you knew that one of your competitors has been caught and nobody does anything. I thought this was something very weird in a democracy. But, I mean, to my surprise, I found out that being abducted was a relief for other of my political rivals. And it was very strange to hear their statements in the radio while I was being captured. And you know, feeling in the tone of the voice and the words they were using, that in a way, it was like, Let's continue. Let's move on. I mean, too bad that she's been taken, but we have to win this campaign. It was very strange.
You were also able, on occasion, when you had access to a radio, to hear messages, particularly from your mother. Can you talk about that? Because this is a system that we do not have in this country that exists in Colombia. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, this is a very weird thing. You see, in Colombia, there are 3,000 abductees. I mean, people that have been kidnapped for all kind of reasons, mm-hmm. especially for economical reasons. And because there are so many people, families tend to try to find ways to communicate with their loved ones, even though it's just a one-way communication. So the radio stations, some of them, have given the space they have broadcasting to allow the families to send messages to their loved ones that have been kidnapped. So when you are when you are in captivity, by listening to the radio and listening to those programs that everybody can listen in Colombia, you might hear the voice of your mother, of your father, of your children, sending a message precisely to you. So it became kind of a routine in our daily lives as prisoners, as kidnapped people, to listen to the radio on those specific programs, to listen to our families. And my mother would come to these radio programs every day. Every day I heard my mom send me a message and updating me with what was happening with my family, with my children, with the political situation and the negotiation that was or was not going on. I mean, with the solution for us being liberated. So it was very important to have this presence, even though she couldn't know I was listening. Nobody knew. It came to a point where there were some corpses that were found in a mass grave, and people thought that it could be me. And they told my mother that they had found my body. And she reacted in a way that I admire, because not knowing anything and not having any way to just you know, just by her feeling, she said, no, that's not her. Mm. I'm sure she's alive. I can feel it in my heart. So that was the situation. I mean, she didn't know that I was listening to her messages. She gave messages every day, and that kept me alive.
How often did you think that you were going to be killed?
Well, you know, death comes to be like a thing that, I mean, it's familiar when you are in as a hostage, mm-hmm. because you can die for all kind of reasons. Of course, you can die from a bullet from one of the guards, but especially in the jungle, you have the feeling that you could die in an accident, of a tree falling on you, or drowning in the river, or, I mean, there are so many dangers that surrounds you that you have the feeling that death is kind of something that could happen anytime. I remember when I was, the moment I was abducted, they separated me from the group I was, and that triggered in my mind images of people that had been killed on the road by the guerrilla, especially politicians like myself. And I thought, this is it. They're going to kill me. It's not an abduction. It's going to be a murder. And that was one of the times I thought that could happen. It also happened in the times I was trying to escape. Mm-hmm. When I tried to escape and I was caught, I always feared that, you know, the punishment could be execution. They had done it before to other people and to some of my fellow hostages that died that way. So it was something that it was there. It was there all the time.
Was there ever a point where you thought it would just be easier if they would kill me?
For me, yes, mm-hmm. of course. Sometimes I thought that it would be easier. I didn't want them to kill me in a way, because I thought, but I really thought that dying in a military operation, in a rescue operation, was better than not to have the military operation of rescue. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a huge, you know, discussion, especially with the families of the hostages, because none of them, nor my mother or my children or the families of my fellow hostages, wanted the government to attempt a rescue operation because of the risk of us dying. And I remember having these discussions with my fellow hostages and saying, look, I want to have the opportunity to bear that risk, because I prefer to die in an attempt of liberation than to die here as an old woman, or because of illness and not be treated, or in an accident. So, yes, this was something that we would discuss very often.
My guest is Ingrid Betancourt, former Colombian senator and anti-corruption activist who was running for president in 2002 when she was kidnapped by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. We're talking this hour about her new book, Even Silence Has an End, My 6 Years in Captivity in the Colombian Jungle. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ingrid Betancourt, former Colombian senator and presidential candidate who was kidnapped by the FARC in 2002. Her new book is called Even Silence Has an End, My 6 Years in Captivity in the Colombian Jungle. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Ingrid, throughout the time that you were in captivity, you described the guards as being alternately almost compassionate to you and then just incredibly vicious and nasty. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of relationships that you had to the people who guarded you?
Yes, Chris. I think it's very human in a way. I remember before being abducted, seeing this Stanford experience. I don't know if you have heard about that, but it was. I had the opportunity of seeing the footage of the experience, like 3 months before my abduction, and it's something that really was very helpful in understanding what happened. Mm-hmm. I think that we in positions where you have people that have authority over others, if you are not. If you don't have the frame of the law and of ethical principles, you can degrade your behavior and become very cruel and sometimes sadistic. So this is something that happened in the jungle because we were in the jungle. So there was nobody to just look what was happening or to witness the treatment we were subject to. There was no law to protect us. There was nothing. We were confronted to guards. They were adolescents for the most part of them. And they had a basic training, really no culture, no education. And so you could see how if in the beginning you would have like some kind of interest coming from them in trying to know who we were. After, I would say, 3 or 4 weeks, and it was very quick, this impression that you are dealing with people that you can manipulate, that you can submit to your will, degenerates, and slowly people that in the first contact were naturally good can become cruel, abusive, humiliating, and this, of course, increases with a sensation of frustration because, in a way, they could feel that because of us, because they had to guard us, they couldn't be in some place, perhaps else, where they wanted to be. They were, in a way, trapped with us in the jungle. Hmm. They couldn't just leave and go to, for example, a town or do something that perhaps was more appealing to them as young people they were. So this frustration, the fact that they would be trained and brainwashed in seeing us like enemies, and the fact that there was this hierarchy that would make them feel not responsible for the treatment they were giving us because they would feel they were just following orders, all of that opened the way for all kinds of abuses.
Do you see some of those guards as victims of the FARC to nearly the same extent you were, or do you see them as responsible for their own actions?
I think it's a combination of both. Mm-hmm. I think, of course, you are always, as a human being, in control of who you are. I mean, you have a choice. You have the choice of being what you want to be. And this... I say this because I cannot justify any of the treatments we were subject to because of other considerations, education or age or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that these kids, because they were really kids, came from a background of exclusion. They were living in the jungles in Colombia, which means that they were... They were very in the lowest probably level of the society of the pyramid, of the social pyramid. There were peasants, but there were peasants in the jungle. There were not peasants in a zone where they could have roads and they could have markets and they could sell their products. They were hiding in a way in the jungle because they were related with the production of coca. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they were peasants that were subject to all kind of violence because they were chased by the military. But they were also exploited and abused by their own bosses, the ones who the drug lords who would buy the crop. And so for them, getting into the guerrilla, having a gun or a machine gun, and wearing a uniform and being part of an organization was an upgrade in their lives, definitely. But once they were in the guerrilla, once they accepted to get in the system, they lost their freedom. They couldn't go back. And if they wanted to flee because they decided that was not what they wanted, they knew that that was very risky because the punishment for fleeing the FARC for them was execution, martial court and execution. There were also cases, especially in the Indians, the guerrillas that were from Indian origin, which was even worse because they were forced to be there. They had no choice. I mean, it was like the guerrilla would oblige the tribes, the Indian tribes living in the jungle, to give them a percentage of the young people they had. So it was horrible. I mean, I remember having a guard, a very young guy. He must have been 14 or 15 at the time. Hmm. And he was crying at night because he wanted to go back to his mom. And this is incredible, but that was the case. So yes, in some cases, definitely, they were as hostage as I was.
How excruciating for you, though, to have these two teenage children at the time that you wanted more than anything to get back to? Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the thoughts you allowed yourself to have about your children and the things maybe you had to sort of push aside just to focus on your own survival?
Well, that was the most difficult part for me. I discovered that in all the things that I lost during those terrible years of abduction, the ones that made me suffer the most was the ones related to my children not being a mom. That was for me, and I discovered that that was the most precious thing I had in life. So, well, during my captivity, a month after my abduction, I lost my father. My father died. I didn't know about it. I just discovered in a very hard way for me. And from the moment I got to know that my father had died and the pain it caused, that was so huge. I realized that I couldn't. It was, the pain was too overwhelming, and I couldn't just face it like I thought I was capable of. So one of the things I did was not allowing myself to think about my children, just because thinking of them was too painful. Mm-hmm. I couldn't. I mean, it was like opening a faucet. I would cry all day long. So in order to try to move on, I just decided that. And the only moments where I gave myself the permission to think of my children was the day of their birthday. And I did special things just to mark that day because I didn't want to forget what I was doing, where I was the day they were turning 17 or 14, and every year it was every year it was more difficult than the previous one, which at the end of the experience, when I came back and we were talking, I was talking with my children, I could tell them exactly what I was doing when all of the years that I couldn't be with them.
Hmm. Was there part of you that hoped they weren't thinking every minute about what you were enduring?
Yes, absolutely. I just prayed that they just they could just let go and not be obsessive of what was happening to me. I wanted them to be free and to leave their youth and to be able to be happy and to move on in their lives. And I remember at one point where I was very sick and I had no medical attention from the guerrilla, and I thought I was probably going to die, thinking, well, that would be perhaps the best thing that could happen, because then my children would be free. I mean, truly free. They would be able to just, you know, have their grief and just think that I'm dead and move on in their life. For me, the pain that I was causing with my abduction to the people I loved was just unbearable. And I think that was why I tried so many times to escape. I mean, it was my obsession. I wanted to get back home.
Knowing every time that if and when you got caught, you were horribly, savagely beaten and abused.
Yes. Yes, that was true. It was horrible. But then again, even that was better than just not doing anything and waiting for something to happen that I thought might not happen, because I was very aware that the Colombian government didn't want to negotiate with the guerrillas. And I could see that there was nothing that would be done in order to get us free from the FARC. And at the same time, I knew that the FARC didn't want to negotiate us either, because we were trophies for them. Every time people would talk about us, it was media exposure for the FARC. And I thought it was, in their way of thinking, it was better for them to just have us hostages for, you know, I mean, I remember one guard telling me that the FARC had planned to keep us for 20 years. Mm. So, and the way they were saying it was kind of, you know, harsh, saying, you will come out of here as a grandmother. And of course I wanted to be a grandmother, but not in abduction. So I wanted to get back.
So your entire adult life, based on what I've read about your career, was extremely busy and productive. It doesn't sound like you had much more than half an hour ever of time that wasn't structured and busy. How did you cope with the boredom of being in captivity?
Yes, that was something that was crucial, because, of course, boredom is the path to depression.
Yeah.
And it was something that I didn't want to happen. So I filled my days with things. At the beginning, I had nothing to do. I had no books. I had nothing. So I would walk all day around the place where we would sleep was called the Caleta. It was just a place where we would have a plastic sheet on the floor, and probably, if we were lucky, a mosquito net and some kind of roof, plastic roof, just protect us from the rain. Mm-hmm. And that was in the middle of the jungle. So what I would do is just go around that place, that caleta, for hours in order to just do something. Afterwards, I just sophisticated a little bit my activity, and then I began doing exercises and trying to build things that could make me feel like in a gym. So I would have weights and things that I would made with things that I would find in the jungle in order to be able to work out. I was lucky enough to ask for a Bible and get one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very important, and because it changed my life, truly. And then it came to a moment when I was abducted with other people, other prisoners. On the second year of abduction, we were united with other hostages, and they had books, and we could, you know, exchange things. And one of the things we exchanged were books, and so I got to read, for example, the famous Harry Potter, and that was amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Could you lose yourself in a story? Were you able to really just be away from where you were inside that book?
Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my escape. And I think that was why it was so important for all of us as prisoners to have something to read, because it was just, while we were reading, we were out of the jungle. So it was very important to have the mind set on something that would give us hope or would us. And then I have to admit that the presence of my other companions, I mean, the people that were hostage with me, was fundamental for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned many things just by looking at them. And, you know, there were people that had this incredible capacity of having, you know, a sense of humor in the darkest moments. And that was so important, to be able to laugh at our condition, even when it was so dramatic. So those are, you know, escape things that you need to be able to just cope with the situation.
There were also times, though, when, and sometimes at the encouragement of the guards, that prisoners didn't get along, because you were in incredibly crowded spaces, and you were in some ways in competition for everything from food to an extra pair of shoes to anything.
Yes, it was a fight. It was a war. And it was also first, of course, the situation that made us fight for anything, from some food to space. Mm-hmm. But it was also all the information that the guerrillas would feed us with in order to make us fight, because they needed to divide us. So they would say things that other had said, or gossip. Mm-hmm. And we were very sensitive to all those kind of things, because we would think that, I mean, it was difficult to just live in a cohabitation where we didn't have any privacy, where we had to share everything with people we didn't know, with people, sometimes the characters of the people we were forced to live with were not easy to live with. So everything was there to make it difficult. But I think that, of course, that was part of what we had to learn to cope with, the others. But I think it was also a source of wisdom. I think that we learned a lot, all of us.
Let me jump in and have a break here, excuse me. My guest is former Colombian presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt. Her new book is called Even Silence Has an End, My 6 Years in Captivity in the Colombian Jungle. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Colombian senator and presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt. Her book, out now in trade paperback, is called Even Silence Has an End, My 6 Years in Captivity in the Colombian Jungle. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Ingrid, I want to talk about the operation in 2008 that brought you to freedom. In some ways, it's like the ultimate story of a perfectly run covert operation. Can you tell us about what you were aware of as this was all going on?
Well, we didn't know anything about it. I mean, it took us by surprise, and the liberation was, because of that, one of the most incredible moments of my life. The day before the rescue, we were taught that we had to change places, and somehow they were expecting a group of European ONG
aid workers,
members, mm-hmm. that would come to talk to us. That was the official. I mean, that was what the FARC thought that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Some kind of guys coming from the European Parliament to come and talk with us. The next day in the morning around 10, the commander came to see us and to tell us that not only the Europeans were going to come and talk to us, but that we were supposed to get into the helicopter, because we were going to go to another camp where we would be able to talk with the head of the FARC, the supreme commander of the FARC, and then we would be held in some other place. So there was no liberation in the schedule. Mm-hmm. It was only we were going to shift camps. And, of course, that was something that made us all very nervous because we thought helicopters, that means that they're going to send us further into the jungle and it will be even more hard to find us and to try to free us. That morning, the helicopter landed in a field of coca field, and they forced us to get into the helicopter. Nobody wanted, and we were handcuffed because being handcuffed, some of my companions reacted in a very violent way, mm-hmm. Saying that they didn't want to get into the helicopter. I mean, it was a rough moment, very, very difficult. Finally, we got into the helicopter. Two of the chiefs of the group came with us and got into the helicopter too. And once the helicopter was in the air, there was a fight. There was a fight between the two commanders of the FARC that had got into the helicopter with us and the crew who was supposed to be allied with the FARC. Hmm. And those guys were from the Colombian Army. And so they neutralized the two guerrillas, and they told us that this was freedom. And it was an incredible moment because, of course, it was like a miracle. I mean, we couldn't believe that we were living what we were living in that precise moment, that we were in a helicopter that was taking us home. And then it was also kind of frightening because we were not prepared for freedom.
Yeah.
I mean, to confront our families, to confront our new life, to confront the future. And I remember that our reaction was a reaction. We all screamed and cried. And in that screaming and in that crying, there were all kind of emotion mixed together.
Do you blame the Colombian government for what happened to you?
No, not at all. No, I don't think the Colombian government was aware of what happened. Of course, you could say that they could have negotiated sooner, or they could have done an operation sooner. But, well, that's speculation, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that what happened is the responsibility of the FARC. Nobody could foresee that this was going to happen. So, well, that happened, and that's all.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We will speak with John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I just heard that, you know, Ingrid doesn't have anything against the Colombian government. I just want a little bit more information about her lawsuit against the Colombian government and how people reacted to her book in Colombia. And I'll take my question up here.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you, John. Yes, well, personally, I only have gratitude for the Colombian government because they finally did the rescue operation. Now, there is a law in Colombia that was enacted before our liberation that gives the right to the victims of terrorism to ask for economic compensation. It's a right that has been recognized by the Colombian law, and it exists in many other countries, mm-hmm. where there is terrorism. There's something that is done. It's a way of compensating the let's say the incapacity of the state to protect its citizens in front of terrorism. And it's a solidarity, social solidarity in a way. Mm-hmm. This compensation was demanded or asked by all of my fellow hostages. And I was warned by them that, well, there was a deadline to present the demand of compensation. And when I did it, when I present my papers and my documents to ask for the compensation, The Colombian government at the time reacted in a very aggressive way, saying that I was suing in justice the soldiers that had liberated me, which, of course, was everything but a lie. Then they said that I was pretending to get rich with the money of with my abduction, which was horrible to say this. I mean, there is a law that presents the possibility for compensation for the suffering of the victims of terrorism, and here they were saying that the purpose of the procedure was to get rich. I think that all of this was something that was done with political interest behind. I think that the political Colombian class was frightened that I could get back to Colombia and take a political space that perhaps they didn't want to just give to anybody, and especially not to me. And the reaction in Colombia was very humiliating, very hard, very... It was a very hard moment for my family and for me. I think that it was unjust and it was not fair. But that's the way it was. So that was the reaction of in Colombia in front of the lawsuit, which in it was not a proper lawsuit. It was a procedure in
a claim for damages. Yeah. Do you feel like you can't go back?
Well, I don't want to go back, which is different. I think that there are wounds still open in my heart towards Colombia. There are things that have hurt me a lot, and I just, you know, I love my country. This is a country that has shaped my life. I just dream with so many things for Colombia, and I want my country to be something different from what we are right now. I think we deserve to be a country where we could live in peace and where there could be social justice. Dreams, basic dreams that I think everybody has, but I see that to achieve those dreams, there are things that have to change profoundly in the way our society is constructed and in the way we relate to each other. And one of the things that have to be changed, I think, is the heart. We have to have a better heart, to be more compassionate, to be more open to others. I think that perhaps because Colombia has been a country with so many violence for so many years, I mean, it's a century of violence, the way we interact between Colombians is kind of cold, and sometimes we don't want to get involved in the pain of others. But as long as we have this kind of behavior, I don't think we will achieve what we have to achieve, which is to have a country with opportunity for everyone.
Have you struggled with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, of course. We all have.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have gone through the normal path of that syndrome.
Yeah.
I am today able to say that I'm a happy person. I don't have resentment for anyone. I have tried to save from those years what could be saved, which is, you know, the love I had for my fellow hostages. They are my family, the people that lived with me through all those years. We shared so many things, and it's important for me to just, you know, keep the contact and be there for them, and I know they're there for me too, so that is important. And I think it's a treasure. I mean, from all those years that, you know, could bring sad memories, there are also things that brighten life, and those are the things that I want to keep.
Has it been, I mean, I imagine it's been a joyful process, but also a sorrowful one in some ways, getting to know your children who were, by the time you were released, adults and different people, certainly, than the ones you had left behind?
Well, it was a huge challenge, because I was in front of people that were different from the kids I left. Mm-hmm. As simple as that. And not only that, but I was a mother of two adults that I admired, mm-hmm. because the way they really struggled and fought for my freedom, I thought was admirable. And they grew in a way that I couldn't have expected to be more enlightening. And so I was in front of people that were amazing. So I was shy. I was intimidated when I came back.
Was it hard to give them the book when you were finished with it?
I couldn't. I couldn't give them the book. It was very difficult for me to... And it was difficult for them to read it, too. Mm-hmm. But I think it was important that we found the way... I mean, for example, my daughter read the book completely. And so I think there are things that she understands better than my son, that perhaps he refused to go beyond the 100-page. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he arrived to a point where he said, "No, it's too awful, I don't want to continue reading."
Yeah.
And so, well, perhaps he will do it afterwards in a while. But it has been also a marvelous experience to just be there and discover them and try to make bridges and to open doors, especially with my son. Because with my daughter, I think it was kind of a luck, you know. When I came back, the first thing I talked with her was, "Look, Melanie, I don't have anything to wear. Could you just lend me something? Because I have nothing." And she said, "Look, we're the same size. I mean, you can have whatever you want. What pick up what you want." And this thing that was, I mean, you know, nothing special, but it created a bond of complicity between my daughter and myself, which makes everything so easy between the two of us. With my son, it was a kind of different, because he was 13 at the time I was abducted, and he was very keen in making me understand that he was not anymore a boy, that I had in front of me a man. And, of course, it was obvious, and I could see it. But then it was important for me to open a dialogue where I could be close to his heart, that I could know what was happening inside of him, and I could be there. And sometimes it was hard, because sometimes, you know, being a mom is, you have to say things that the other doesn't want really to hear.
I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Ingrid Betancourt's memoir is called Even Silence Has an End, My 6 Years in Captivity in the Colombian Jungle. Ingrid, we're glad you made it out alive, and thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.